Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
It's Here and Now. Indian Prime Minister Manmohan Singh told Congress today that he supports American efforts to spread democracy. He said he deplores terrorists and is ready to responsibly expand his country's civilian nuclear program. During his speech at the Capitol, Singh also promoted India's desire to become a permanent member of the UN Security Council.
The United Nations Security Council must be restructured. Ladies and gentlemen, in this context, you would agree with me that the voice of the world's largest democracy surely cannot be left unheard on the Security Council when the United Nations is being restructured.
But in fact, President Bush does not agree that India's voice be heard from the Security Council chamber. On the line from Washington to talk with us about this and other aspects of the Prime Minister's speech is UPI's Deputy International Editor, Krishnadev Kalamur. Welcome, Krishnadev.
Hi.
You covered the speech this morning. Let's start with the last thing, one of the last things the Prime Minister mentioned, which is the United Nations. It's a point of contention between the U.S. and India. What are the President's objections to seeing India on the Security Council?
I don't think it's a matter of the United States having problems with India per se. If you look at what they've said in the past, it's they're open to one or two members being included in an expanded council, but they've expressed support only for Japan. The problem I think they have is they don't see it as an immediate priority. They feel there's other things that need to be changed at the UN, and the UN Security Council reform is not right on their list of priorities right now.
Is this a serious disagreement?
I don't think it is. I mean, I think if you look at where it was in Manmohan Singh's speech today, it was right toward the end. 6 months ago, perhaps, there was a lot of steam in India for a permanent seat in the UN or in an expanded council. But right now, I think the placement in the speech probably reflects that there is some kind of an agreement, understanding that, well, we're not going to get on this time, but if there is going to be expansion sometime in the future, we probably are on the list.
A lot of the speech was fairly predictable, spent more than half of it talking about democracy, the fight against terror. Were there any surprises for you in the speech?
I don't think so. I think basically, as you point out, the speech can be divided into two major sections. The first part was the whole war on terror, and I think he took on a pretty muscular approach toward it. And the other one was the economic, opening up India's markets. He was finance minister in the early 90s, and he began the economic liberalization program, and he wanted to make sure that was continuing, and acknowledged that reforms were sometimes slow, but he wanted it to continue and made it a point to say it was irreversible, and hopefully providing incentives to American companies to go in.
Let's talk a little bit more about that in the areas of trade and agriculture. Can you tell us anything more about what you detected from this speech in terms of what may have come out of their discussions yesterday?
I think we're looking at a new phase of Indo-US relations. It goes beyond the whole Pakistan parameter. They're discussing trade, obviously agriculture. I think joint research, Manmohan Singh mentioned the second green revolution. I think that's going to be a pretty big aspect of India's policy. It's something that he needs to take back home to, because one of his big allies in parliament are the communists, and they've put pressure on him not to. He doesn't want to be seen as giving away too much. So I think when he takes back something like agriculture, which is the backbone of the Indian economy, 40% or so, it looks like he's taking something strong back. And I think that's definitely something that will be applauded.
Coming home with the goods. If there is a surprise anywhere, it is in this area of nuclear technology. A day after the president issued a joint statement stating that India could acquire some of the same benefits and advantages as other states. How are his comments received here and in India?
Well, in India, I had dinner with a few Indian journalists yesterday who were visiting, and the reaction cannot be happier. I mean, India has longed for this kind of treatment since 1998. India has seen itself as a responsible democratic nuclear power, and Singh made these points in his speech, and he feels that since India has taken these steps to safeguard its technology, you should treat India the way you would treat any other nuclear power, a responsible nuclear power. And in India, at least, this is his big deal. He takes this back. It's really going to endear him to the public. And, you know, there's very little the opposition can say.
But you're here in Washington, and that may be a harder sell in the U.S.
Well, that's probably true. That is probably true. Although I think, with the House being controlled by the Republicans, it may not be such a bad thing, because I think at least the Indians view the Republicans as closer to their cause than the Democrats are.
Krishnadev Kalamur is Deputy International Editor of UPI and spoke with us from Washington, D.C. Thanks, Krishnadev.
Thank you very much.
Joining me here in the studio is Adil Najam. He is a professor of international relations at the Fletcher School at Tufts University in Medford, Massachusetts, a regular guest on Here Now. Welcome back, Adil.
Thank you.
The two governments are saying this is historic. Prime Minister Singh calls this a refashioning of bilateral relations. In your opinion, is that what's going on here?
Historic doesn't happen every day, but this is really important. This is important. This could be the beginning of a great friendship. And a very important set of relations between two major powers. What's happening in India? India is going through a massive and major transformation, a very exciting transformation. We think of India as one big call center. It's much more. It's much more. The transformation is not just call centers. It's high tech. It's large companies investing in what they think is going to be the next big knowledge economy.
Well, economics is important, and we're going to talk more about that later, but this is really more than economics, isn't it?
It's much more than economics. It's about politics. It's about the future of Asia. It's about the war on terror. It's about much, much deeper things than economics. It's also about two societies that are going to play major roles in this century.
In particular, then, how are things changing with regard to U.S.-Indian relations? Let's take a look at security.
Security is a tough neighborhood where India is, where Pakistan is, where China is. For the U.S., the top priority has been and is the war on terror. India also has, as this emerging power, a much greater interest in regional stability than it has had in the past. Because if you are running an international enterprise in Bombay or New Delhi, you don't want NPR to be talking about the possibility of nuclear war, because you're going to lose customers. So the whole dynamic of international relations in that sense is changing with globalization, and India's being this major player in the globalization game.
And how does the U.S. see its relations with India playing a part of that? In other words, what is it that we're doing now, and how would things change to make that a more stable part of the world?
A number of things have changed. Historically, India sort of tilted towards the Soviet Union during the Cold War. And that was really the framework within which India and U.S. relations were structured. The other part of that framework was U.S.-Pakistan relations. And there was this zero-sum game mentality that if the U.S. is closer to Pakistan, it must be far away from India. And that's what's changing. What the U.S. is now doing is it's saying to both of them that, look here, we are your friends, and it's not either or. And that changes the dynamic in the region. So when trouble arises in the region, it's no longer China and Russia who are the key players. It's the U.S., and that happened with Clinton and then again with Bush.
What happens in this whole business of sharing nuclear technology? We know that, India is a non-signatory to the Non-Proliferation Treaty. This is something that we've said we don't share technology with those countries. Now, if we do, what does that do to the balance and this business of U.S. being fair broker with regard to Pakistan?
A number of things. First, we have to see how the Europeans react to this, because there's this odd thing. We are telling the Europeans not to impose sanctions on some countries, and then we are saying we will take them off other countries. Mm. Now, here it's much more problematic. All of the other economic stuff is win-win. Nuclear stuff is more difficult. The first problem, as your earlier question to your guest pointed out, if the U.S. makes this this gesture to India, it will have a lot of pressure from Pakistan, from President Musharraf, who is a major ally, to get reciprocity there. Now, that's going to lead into all sorts of other problems, particularly with recent events in Pakistan's nuclear, the AQ Khan scandal and all of that. The other thing is the U.S. fingerprint on proliferation in the region is rather large. In the sense that when India tested, we kind of winked, scowled, and said, okay, we'll live with it. Then India went outwardly nuclear. And again, we kind of scowled and we said, okay, we learned to live with it. Then Pakistan did the same. And we sent a message which is now coming home to roost, both with the North Koreans, with the Iranians. And I think the future of the non-proliferation regime is really being worked out here.
So you're suggesting that the whole notion of non-proliferation may be at stake here, that this idea may be what's under,
I think,
under scrutiny?
Yeah, I think it's more than changing. It has changed. Yeah. The mystique is over. The mystique was over. We let the U.S. and we the world, three countries, India, Israel, Pakistan, to go nuclear and essentially stand and say, we don't like it, but we won't do anything. And what we now see is lots of other countries saying, well, maybe that's the route to go.
What about the other side of this in Pakistan, where there certainly President Musharraf has a tenuous relationship with the Islamic the fundamentalists in that country? Could the U.S. be worried that, that government may fall, that this could become an Islamic country, and perhaps bolstering India as a bulwark against that?
It could be a possibility. Certainly elements in Pakistan will see and present it as that, and sort of the anti-American, anti-Musharraf camps will say, look here is proof. The reason U.S. is coming close to India is really because they want India to keep an eye on Pakistan, which may or may not be so. But I think from a global perspective, the U.S. would also want relations with India because India can keep an eye on China, right? It's not just India-Pakistan dynamic here. There's a major India-China dynamic, including a war. And therefore, as we were talking earlier, there's a lot of incentive for the U.S. to build this relationship, which is going to be a strategic relationship economically, strategically in terms of Pakistan, Iran, Afghanistan, the west of India, and also the north of India with respect to China.
So as China becomes a huge economic engine, a huge economic power on the world scene, it may be in the U.S. interest to build or make sure that there is a counterbalancing military power in that part of the world.
A lot of what's going to happen in the world is going to be centered around that part of the world, China and India. And you want friends there. And in many ways, India is a better candidate for that long-term friendship than China.
Very briefly, are there things that have changed in the relationship between the U.S. And just in terms of how we view India? You talked about the end of the Soviet Union.
Yeah, the Indian story, the India-U.S. story is not just based in India. It's really based here in the U.S., which is the what's called the NRI, the non-resident Indian, the Indian-American, which is one of the largest and certainly one of the fastest-growing immigrant groups. It's one of the most affluent. It is clearly one of the most educated. It's very, very influential politically, very, very influential technologically. And if you saw the dinner last night at the White House, the guest list had a lot of very well-off, very important, influential Indian Americans.
Adil Najam teaches international relations at Tufts University Fletcher School. Adil, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Just ahead, as India's economic power grows, the U.S. relationship changes later in the show. After that, federal investigators looking into a lavish bachelor party thrown for a Fidelity trader who was engaged to marry Dennis Kozlowski's daughter. There's more coming up here and now. It's here and now. Today we're talking about the groundbreaking improvement in relations between the United States and India. This comes as India's Prime Minister is visiting the U.S. Today he addressed a joint session of Congress and called for strengthening economic ties.
India's growth and prosperity, I sincerely believe, is in America's own interest. American investments in India, especially in the new technology areas, will help American companies to reduce costs and become more competitive globally.
India is Asia's fourth largest economy. It's expected to grow 7% by next year. Joining us to talk about India's growth and what it means for U.S.-India relations is Tarun Khanna, a professor of business administration at Harvard Business School. Welcome, Professor.
Good afternoon, Frank.
You know, we talk about things like strengthening economic ties between the U.S. and India, and that always sounds like a good thing. But then when we think about our economic relationship with India, folks tend to get scared. They think of jobs being exported abroad. What precisely is our economic relationship with India?
Well, I think, Frank, there's no doubt that there's anxiety caused by job losses and outsourcings and things of that nature, though I think most of the evidence suggests that it's a pretty small amount when benchmarked against conventional annual job losses due to technical change and things of that nature. And on the other hand, there's a lot of complementarity to the extent that a company like GE does a lot of its software development or manufacturing in places like China and India. That comes back to help other Americans, such as medical technicians and hospitals and surgeons and things of that nature. So that's a complementary aspect to a relationship with a developing country like India or China.
Professor Khanna, we always hear about India's strength, especially in the IT sector, software development, software engineering, etc. Why is that?
There are a couple of reasons. The most important, I think, is that there is freedom of expression and freedom of intellectual property, so to speak, in India, and just like you see in the United States, slightly less efficient, but the same spirit. And so you see a lot of people basically willing to experiment with their ideas and try it out. And at this point, I think it's spread considerably beyond basic IT. It's gone to precision manufacturing, it's gone to the media, it's gone to the entertainment, it's gone to clinical testing, it's gone to generation of new molecules in pharma drug discovery. So it's really running the gamut. And the second reason, I think, is that a long time ago in the 50s and 60s, certain decisions were made serendipitously, as far as we're concerned today, to build tertiary education centers of excellence, which now produce enormous amounts of, think of them as the equivalent of MIT, Caltech types of folks. And since India's population is so large and since the competition to get into these institutions is so draconian, what you have is extremely high caliber, large numbers of these people coming out every year.
In terms of trade, is India a very large market for U.S. goods?
It is not currently. My prediction is it will be an enormous market. It's also growing very fast, much faster than any point in the past. And that, I think, is a reflection of the fact that India has finally opened up to the world.
It's interesting. You talk about India opening up its markets. China has done the same thing, but in a very different way. And there are some, I think, interesting comparisons between the way India has developed its economy and China under a more totalitarian structure, albeit somewhat more open than in the past.
You're very right to say that the ways in which the openness has happened in China and is happening in India are radically different. China, for instance, is very open to foreign direct investment. India has conventionally not been very open to foreign direct investment. It's changing, but changing very slowly. On the other hand, India has always been much more open to ideas, to the free movement of people in and out of the country. And India continues to be much more open to portfolio investment than China is.
What do you mean by portfolio investment?
By portfolio investment, I mean you're buying shares in a particular company or mutual funds that invest in companies. The problem is that the capital market in China is so poorly functioning that it wouldn't make sense for an arm's length, relatively uninformed investor sitting in New York or London to invest in shares of Chinese companies directly. What happens is that in India, because the market actually works very well, especially the equity market, there's no problem with doing that kind of investment, and it ends up being a substitute for actually building a factory.
And that's because the Chinese government actually makes decisions about where the capital is going to go, which
that's
businesses
exactly
are
right.
going to be developed. And in India, the market decides that.
India is pretty much a free market. Think of it as a less efficient version of the United States. The amazing thing here is that the Indian system is so much closer to the United States system.
In the short run, anyway, there are some advantages to this, it seems, for China in developing infrastructure. If you target where the money goes, you can develop that industry more quickly and get roads built and ports deepened and all that sort of thing.
No question. I think China is the most amazing development success story, if you're willing to overlook the problems with personal freedoms and rights and so on that inevitably are compromised in a totalitarian society. But from the standpoint of actually delivering food to poor people, simple health care, roads, power, it's a hands-down success story, and it completely eclipses India, no question. So it's really, making different trade-offs between individual rights and collective welfare in some ways.
We have been talking about the ways that businesses can develop. What has been the impact on poverty in India? Have the poorest of the poor truly been helped by any of this?
The overall poverty measures have been reduced drastically in the last 10 to 15 years as a result of economic growth. The reduction in poverty is not as dramatic as in China, But nonetheless, it's an impressive accomplishment.
Looking back at the United States now, you talked a little bit about the, you call it complementarity, the fact that this kind of trades both ways. How does the payback to the American economy help strengthen the American jobs picture?
You know, I think we've been here many times before. If we adopt the fullness of historical time, and every time there's a shock to not just the U.S. economy, but to any economy of this magnitude, such as the rise of China and India, there is a sectoral reallocation. One of the things that the U.S. is extremely good at doing is redeploying its human capital in ways that many other countries, you know, for instance, Germany, are not nearly as good at doing. And there's no question that you'll see pockets of wealth creation coming out of places like China and India and some of the other big emerging markets. So you'll see a little bit more of a dispersed economic world as opposed to unipolar New York-centered world.
Sarun Khanna is a professor of business administration at Harvard Business School. Professor Khanna, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Frank.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, Al-Qaeda post Bali, Madrid, and London. And we spin a few new tribute CDs with our jazz man, James Isaacs. That's tomorrow. Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now. And Young is off today. It's Here and Now. A private jet carrying Wall Street traders to a lavish bachelor party in South Beach, Florida, is now under federal investigation. The Securities and Exchange Commission and the National Association of Securities Dealers are examining several trading firms who they believe ponied up gobs of cash in order to bribe a one-time star trader at Fidelity Investments. The weekend party included private jets, a yacht, meals served by waiters on jet skis, plenty of drugs, women, and a dwarf. More on that in a moment. The story first broke in the Wall Street Journal, and joining us now on the line is Journal reporter Suzanne Craig. Hi, Suzanne.
Hi, Frank.
There's a lot of important issues here, but first I want to hear more about the party. What went on there?
Well, it was a bachelor party for one of the Fidelity traders. He no longer works there, but he did at the time. And they flew a number of people. They started in Boston, and they stopped in New York, picked up some females and some traders, and investigators are now looking at whether or not the females, whether or not their services were paid for the weekend. Mm-hmm. And then they flew into Miami and into South Beach and spent the weekend celebrating his soon-to-be nuptials. And the reason that this is of interest to a number of regulators and the U.S. Attorney's Office is, first of all, regulators are looking at it because they're concerned that a number of Wall Street firms put up money for it in order to influence Fidelity, which, of course, sends a lot of trading to Wall Street. And they're concerned that the trading didn't go there because they're providing great service, but, in fact, we're providing lavish entertainment to people like Mr. Bruderman. And federal investigators are looking at it because they're concerned that there may have been possible drug use or prostitution at the event.
So there may have been some crimes committed that we all know as crimes. But explain this to me, because all of my funds are currently tied up in groceries, so I don't know too much about the financial world. And if you could explain to me how this influence is peddled, who is selling what to whom?
No, sure. It's a really important issue for investors. I mean, funds or companies like Fidelity are supposed to send, they buy and sell stocks, and they're supposed to send their trades to, you know, Wall Street firms, you know, whether it's, you know, Cowen or Jefferies or some of these firms that are involved.
You know, and Cowen and Jefferies are some of the firms that are alleged to have paid for the party.
Yeah, and they're among the firms that have alleged to pay for it. But Fidelity is supposed to send their business there not because they're getting, you know, gifts and entertainment back, but because, in fact, these firms are providing the best execution. Because people, you know, investors in Fidelity, people who have mutual funds with Fidelity, you know, pay for this. And so they want to make sure that they're getting the absolute best deal. And there's just a concern that, in fact, maybe it was done because they were getting the entertainment and the bachelor parties. And there's a number of other things outside of this weekend that are also under investigation, and not because they were getting a great deal from these firms.
And
that
again,
hasn't been proven, but that's one of the things that regulators are concerned about.
And just to break it down for me a little bit more, these firms like Fidelity go and buy stock, but they can buy it from anybody. If I want to buy a little IBM, I can buy it from you or this broker, broker B or C. And so that's when the kind of a deal that I get matters to
these are trading commissions. This is what you pay to send your trade somewhere when they're, you know, if they want to get out of a stock, if a mutual fund, you know, needs to move a big position of something, who do they pick up the phone and call? Do they phone Goldman Sachs? Mm-hmm. Do they phone Morgan Stanley? Do they phone Cowen? Do they phone Lazard? I mean, this is all, and they should be calling them to move that stock because they're getting the best deal from that firm.
And let's talk a little bit more about this, the party. The party was for Thomas Bruderman Jr. He's a rising star at Fidelity. At one time, he eventually married the daughter of former Tyco International chief Dennis Kozlowski. Kozlowski was convicted of looting his former firm of $150 million. One step ahead. Where's Bruderman now?
Bruderman is no longer at Fidelity. I'm not sure what he's up to other than at this point probably battling a lot of this stuff that, you know, is the fallout from the gift probe that regulators started. But he lost his job several months ago.
And is that because of this?
It was in the midst of it, yeah. Yeah, he was one of the ones disciplined at Fidelity.
And again, help me sort this out. If you're a rising star, I guess it means because you're what, making good choices, buying the right stocks? Is that?
Well, you know what, and this is a great issue. I mean, Fidelity, these are very talented traders. A lot of them have, you know, very strong backgrounds. They're Harvard educated. You know, and there's no they were getting in a lot of cases a really good deal. I mean, the question is you know, were they, you know, not getting as great a deal as they could? But these aren't, you know, these aren't slouches. I mean, a lot of these guys were very sharp traders.
Yeah, I guess, again, when it gets back to what gets lost in the bargain here, can't an investor judge the brokerage house by its choices? If you start making bad deals or I'm not making much money, I go to a different firm, so maybe you shouldn't be paying back these.
Well, that's a question as to whether or not, yeah, where small investors and where investors, if they want to go to Fidelity and if they have concerns, they can go elsewhere. But, I mean, some of this comes down to, you know, not a lot of money. I mean, it comes down to a lot of money, but on a per-share basis, not a lot. And the question for regulators that's going to be tricky still is demonstrating that, in fact, they didn't drive the best bargain. I mean, there's still other violations on the table, but that's going to be a tough one for them to prove. But it's still out there, and people are talking about it. And when you see this kind of stuff where you've got all these Wall Street firms paying for planes and yachts and hotel rooms, it raises some legitimate questions about what happened.
There's one more character, at least one more in this plot, Scott DeSano, who's Bruderman's boss. He's likely the senior-most person who should have known about the wining and dining. And what's he doing now? He's been shifted out, hasn't he?
He has been. He's been reassigned within Fidelity. He is very well known. He's one of the most influential traders on Wall Street, you know, in charge of sending millions of dollars in trades to the street. At least he was. And is, you know, very famous on the street for driving down costs at Fidelity. He also supervised this group that, you know, that are now kind of under the gun for accepting a lot of gifts and gratuities. He himself is being looked at by regulators for this stuff. And he was reassigned. Fidelity is not making a formal connection on it in terms of, you know, whether or not it's related. It certainly comes amidst a huge cloud over the firm.
How has this affected Fidelity's reputation?
I mean, I think it's been really tough for them. I mean, they're a very, you know, a very kind of low-key firm. They're privately held. They're not, you know, publicly traded on a stock exchange, run by the Johnson family in Boston. And the publicity has been very difficult for them. And they value their reputation.
All right. Well, finally, Suzanne, Danny Black.
The dwarf at the party.
Mm-hmm.
He's an interesting character. We don't know who paid for him. He showed up. He was paid for by someone to attend the weekend event, and sort of now in the middle of all of this. So I have a feeling he's going to be getting a lot of calls from securities regulators over the next few days.
Yeah, some very colorful quotes from him.
No, he was quite the character.
Suzanne Craig of the Wall Street Journal, thanks very much.
Great. Thanks a lot, Frank. Bye-bye.
Still to come, we meet an unlikely rap star trained to play classical piano. He's known as Pitch Black Afro. You're listening to Here and Now. The lantern lighting ceremony in the Forest Hills Cemetery of Boston includes Japanese drumming, Scottish bagpipes, and hundreds of paper lanterns decorated by attendees and floated at dusk on Lake Hibiscus to honor those who've passed away. Here Now's Kate Goldring attended last week's ceremony, which is inspired by a Buddhist ritual and has this audio postcard.
The next things happening would be that as you move towards the shore, there will be volunteers with, let's call them lighters, to help you light your lanterns.
I see you have a really beautiful lantern. Do you mind telling me a little bit about it?
Well, they have Japanese characters that mean peace.
And it says July the 7th, London on it, for the event that took place in London. And I wanted to make my lantern for the people who suffered on that day and are still suffering.
And I wanted to make a lot of goofy drawings.
Do you want to describe them for us?
We have a vine that is twirled in three colors, purple, red, and blue. And it looks like it was drawn by a six-year-old, but I actually drew it. And I'm much older than six. And then we have a beautiful temple with a labyrinth in the middle.
And the labyrinth is the path that always leads you to the center. No matter the path of life, you're always on the right path. Yeah. We were actually in London the day before, July the 7th, and we flew to Madrid and heard what happened. And I actually spoke to a friend of mine who had just been through one of those two blinds 10 minutes before it happened. And his fiancé is due to have the baby in 2.5 weeks. So he was a little shocked. I spoke with him that evening.
The people who founded Forest Hills had a vision to create a place of stupendous beauty, really, to offer people a place to come and remember friends and family, and also to celebrate life.
Well, I'm explaining my family. I got my whole family on the lantern. Grandpa Tomizo, they all four grandparents came over from Japan, to Northern California. So this is his name, Tomizo. He's from Ikebukuro, which is a section of Tokyo. And then my father's mother, I was saying that I didn't know her. Her name is Mitsu. And my other sister. And this is the name, the Japanese name for this festival, Toro Nagashi, which is a lantern festival. And what does it mean to me? It means a lot. It means this is the community gathering to honor the ancestors.
Visit to the Forest Hills Lantern Festival was produced by Here and Now's Kate Goldring. To learn more and see a picture, you can go to our website at here-now.org. As always, we welcome your thoughts on our program. You can send us an email at letters@here-now.org. That's HERE-NOW.ORG. Or you can call our listener line and leave us a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. Please tell us how to pronounce your name and tell us the town you're from. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. It's Here and Now. The U.S. has always been something of a cultural colonizer, from Levi's and McDonald's to Disney and Madonna. One of the more recent U.S. exports is hip-hop music. Not only are fans all over the world listening to Nelly and 50 Cent, but locally grown hip-hop musicians rapping in their own language are popping up everywhere. In South Africa, the big name in hip-hop is the artist Pitch Black Afro, a man with a big presence and hair to match. Here and Now, Sean Cole recently encountered him at a nightclub in Johannesburg.
The club's called Monaco, an upscale venue tucked into a largely white suburb of the city. No sneakers allowed. Around 1 in the morning, the dancing gives way to a live show of local performers doing R&B, rap, and a homegrown mishmash of different genres called Kwaito. The room's packed and the crowd's pretty mellow, until an enormous circle of hair with a stick figure body dangling down from it leaps on stage. Suddenly, people are shoving and scrambling for a better view. Pitch Black Afro immediately launches into his theme song, called Pitch Black Afro. It's one of the hits off his debut album Styling Gel, which garnered him 2 nominations at South Africa's version of the Grammys this year. The lyrics are in Zulu and a slangy mixture of different languages called Tsotsi Taal, which translated literally means thug language. He's basically just introducing himself to the music industry, saying who he is, what he's about, that he's been on the scene a while now and that he's here to stay, just like a lot of American rap songs. The chorus is undeniably clear, even if you don't speak the language. It's a call and response. When I say Pitch Black, you say Afro. Up close, Pitch Black Afro is a lot less imposing than he is on stage. Picture Jimmy Walker from Good Times with a massive afro and one front tooth missing. It's all part of the persona, and he's always in character, even in the back of a minivan parked behind the stage at an outdoor show the following night.
Yeah, keep up with what? Yeah, man, you're for a real ride.
I can tell.
You want a lyrical ride? You want a lyrical ride? Come to me. Come to my side.
His real name is Tulani Ngobo. He says Pitch Black Afro was his second choice for a stage name.
I used to call myself Afro at first, and then I met this producer. His name was Afro, and he was like 4 years before me, you know. And I was like, Pitch Black came as me trying to explain what kind of Afro am I.
He says he was the darkest in his class and mercilessly teased for it, even though all of his classmates were black as well. This was in the township of Soweto in the early 1980s, when blacks living under the apartheid regime were made to feel that their color was a stain.
There's this perception of being black is wrong. You know, we were fed that by the regime before us. Black was a sin, but I couldn't change that, so I had to stick with it and deal with it. You know, and the only way of dealing with it is being proud of it, you know?
But being pitch black wasn't the only thing he was teased about. From the time he was little, he's had a speech impediment that should have made a career in rap impossible.
I'm a stutterer. At that time, I was a double and quadruple stutterer. You know, when I prayed, especially aloud, you know, I didn't start. When I sang, I didn't start. So good for me, I had only one way of communication, singing or praying. I had 2 forms, singing or praying. Hence, rapping, you know, like you will never hear me, and you will never hear me stutter when I rap.
Despite growing up in what South African rappers call the ghetto, nothing about Pitch Black's life spelled rap star. He started out as a classical pianist. He even taught music and would do rhymes for his students just to get their attention. He was so good at it that he won himself a spot on a radio contest. Immediately, he was compared to American rapper Busta Rhymes, who has that same quirky staccato delivery. But when you ask Pitch Black who his biggest influence is, he names another American rapper, Redman. New York Times pop critic Kelafasane interviewed Pitch Black for the paper. He says he loves it when foreign rappers dig deep and find less iconic artists, like Redman, to emulate.
So that's why it's so cool to hear the way in which he's influenced by hip-hop. And that's why it's kind of encouraging to realize that it doesn't just have to be hip-hop spreads all over the world and gets popular and people in other countries want to sound like America. No, it's not quite that. It's that hip-hop is big and rich and complicated, and people all over the world react to different things in it, find different traditions within hip-hop, and find different ways to make them their own.
There's less potential for Pitch Black to return the favor and cross over to American audiences, Kelafasane says. Language might be part of it. Even in Johannesburg, it isn't easy to find someone who can parse his polyglot slang. Still, Mpumi Phillips, the marketing manager of his record label, Ghetto Ruff, says the title of one Pitch Black song has entered the local vernacular, Matofo Tofo.
And that's a slang word, but because he's popularized it and made it a kitchen name, you've got the sports anchor saying, oh, that guy played a Matofo Tofo game, you know, which Matofo Tofo means the good things. It's like what he's saying in the song is like, I want the good life, I want a good looking girlfriend, I want the money, I want the cars, I want it all.
But this isn't a bling bling song. Pitch Black just wants to live better than he has been. And while he may not have the money or the cars yet, he's got the girls. As funny looking as he is, women flock to him, wanting him to autograph their boobs.
Yeah, I did expect it, but it's very scary, man.
You did expect it?
Yes, but it's very scary. You know, when you see an older woman, like a 60-year-old woman, wanting you to sign a boob, a big boob like that,
It's just like you've become the most unlikely sex symbol in a way.
I would say the pride of the nation.
Modesty aside, that pride is only likely to grow. His second album is due out early next year, at which point he'll probably have a real afro. For the moment, it's a Pitch Black afro wig.
That piece was reported by Here and Now's Sean Cole. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. Our production team includes Lynn Menegon, April Peavy, Kevin Sullivan, Karen Miller-Medson, and Stefano Katsonis. Our managing editor is Kathleen McKenna. Vince Fairchild is our engineer. He's assisted by Thomas Terry. Our web producer is Ken George. Our interns are Kate Goldring, Joanna Broder, and Noah Suskind. The senior producer of Here and Now is Mark Navin. I'm Frank Stasio. Join us again, Here and Now. Futhi uyishongo lo vula umphongo lo mabebeza ngifaka ithoso lo mkhulu umkhono lo uzungiza usitoko lo fela ubravo lo Pitch Black uthi uvutha more manage Pitch Black wena uthi afro Pitch Black afro Pitch Black afro phethe no DJ Clio esikaleni kazi lami kwazini kungifo kumnyameni ithi Pitch Black wena uthi afro Pitch Black afro Pitch Black afro phethe no DJ Clio umakoya lady mix uzowuthi umoya. For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.